talk with the author of Chronic Disease in the 20th Century, A History, this hour, and we will welcome your questions about how chronic disease became viewed as the most serious problem facing healthcare systems today. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We will not be offering medical advice about specific chronic illnesses this hour, but we will talk about how the concept of chronic illness evolved and how it shaped our healthcare system, and find out how our guest says the concept of chronic disease developed differently in the United States than it did elsewhere, and the medical, public health, and policy responses to it. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Let me welcome our guest. He is George Wise, a professor of social studies and medicine at McGill University and the author of Chronic Disease in the 20th Century, A History. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy.
Tell us how you decided to look at the history of chronic disease.
Well, it was actually, I guess, a bit of luck and a lot of confusion. I was on sabbatical in Europe about 8 years ago, and I was invited to a meeting in London on chronic disease. And some of the papers were on dying cancer patients. Another paper was on the senile patients in old age. A third paper was on asthma. And I walked out of this meeting without any sense of what the term chronic disease actually meant. It lumped together such wildly different conditions that I just became intrigued. I became intrigued by why we would categorize things in such a way. So I went back. I went home to Paris. I was living in Paris at the time. And I began looking into the literature. And much to my surprise, although chronic disease is a very traditional medical term that has been used by doctors for hundreds of years, in thousands of years, actually, the Greeks did it as well, in order to distinguish between short diseases that either killed you or you got better from, and longer lingering diseases, the 20th century literature was almost completely dominated by American medical writing. And my sense of surprise was exacerbated by talking to my French colleagues, who had no idea why I found the idea of chronic disease important or interesting. It wasn't that they didn't understand what chronic disease was. It was just totally irrelevant. Mm. It was just totally irrelevant.
Yeah, and we'll go through some of the important highlights in history and what it all meant, but why would your French colleagues think that your interest in this is, irrelevant, and that that's not as important? They don't think it's as important as you do.
Well, it's not a matter of important. I need to make a distinction here between specific diseases like cancer or rheumatoid arthritis, which the French and the British, who were my main comparison group here, did actually confront even earlier than Americans did. It was this collective term, chronic disease, that was not a very relevant term for them medically. And so the question became for me, what was it about the term that was so attractive to Americans starting remarkably early? Before the United States entered the First World War is when you begin to see the New York City Health Department expressing all kinds of concern about the general problem of chronic disease, you know, lumping together a whole bunch of different conditions, while an infectious disease like tuberculosis remained the dominant a cause of mortality. So really, seven of the 10 chapters of my book are trying to explain, not quite decade by decade, but the major steps by which the United States took this term and made it a central category for defining and formulating health policy, whereas the British and the French, they had other fish to fry, which was essentially, in the case of Britain, creating a national health service for the entire population, and in the case of France, creating a national insurance system, again for the entire population. So there was no interest in any specific category of disease as a key to health policy.
So can you give us the condensed version as to why the United States made this such a central part of our health policy?
Okay, well, to summarize seven chapters, there were a number of things that came into play. First of all, there were specific groups that had a very strong interest in expanding into the area of chronic disease, and two groups in particular were important. The first group was the U.S. Public Health Service, which was in 1920 a very small, not very influential government agency, whose main role was dealing with epidemics and with sanitation, and where there was a strong pressure to expand into new areas. Another area where there was a lot of concern about it was the welfare field. It turned out for welfare officials began doing surveys in the 1920s, and it turned out that many people were on welfare because they were sick, either sick or seriously disabled, and therefore they couldn't work. So in the welfare field, there was considerable interest in which was sort of focused on a chronic disease problem, because they didn't distinguish really between disability and chronic diseases as many people do today. So that was a second area where there was really, and again, New York City was very much at the center of both of these developments. And then a couple of things happened. The issue of chronic disease became, how should I put it? It became implicated in the American political process. By the 1930s, there were many people within the New Deal who also had come from New York City and New York State, so they brought with them their interest in chronic disease, but who were interested in creating some sort of health insurance system. So to demonstrate that a health insurance system was necessary, one of the things they had to do was to demonstrate that the health or the illness situation in America was terrible, especially as a result of the Depression. Well, the problem there was that mortality had been declining pretty regularly since the end of the 19th century, really. And even during the Depression, mortality was declining everywhere. So mortality was not a very good argument in order to demonstrate terrible health conditions. So a group of epidemiologists began focusing on morbidity, which is very, very difficult to demonstrate. I mean, how do you define that somebody is ill? Well, in the course of a process that I won't even try to explain, the epidemiologists came across the notion of days of disability, days when people could not work, or in the case of people who didn't work, which was many housewives, fulfill their normal functions. And when you start thinking about days of disability, lengthy illness becomes a very, very useful way of showing that there is a political problem. So in 1935, the U.S. Public Health Service did a major survey of chronic disease and disability based on days of disability, and lo and behold, The New York Times, when the final report came out in 1938, the New York Times had a huge front page article that went into the second and the third page, talking about the fact that one in five or one in six of every American had a chronic disease and disability. And this was used as a very, very important reason why insurance, national health insurance, should be introduced. And indeed, in 1941, the first attempt to create a health insurance system in the United States was introduced, and which, as everyone knows, failed.
Yeah, let me hold you there, and we will take a short pause, and we'll talk more about how the evolving concept of chronic disease in the United States has affected patients and politics, and how it still influences our healthcare systems today. We are talking with the author of Chronic Disease in the 20th Century, A History. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are talking with the author of Chronic Disease in the 20th Century, A History, and we are welcoming your questions about how chronic disease became viewed as the most serious problem facing healthcare systems today, and how the evolving concept of chronic disease helped shape our healthcare system. And we are welcoming your questions and your concerns at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Our guest is George Wise, a professor of social studies and medicine at McGill University. And we are talking about how the concept of chronic disease developed in the United States and how that's different than what happened elsewhere in Europe, and talking about the medical, public health, and policy response to chronic disease. And we do have we have a caller, so let's go to John in Boaz first. Hi, John.
Hi. Excellent reporting, Joy.
Thank you, John.
Well, I just want one question. My brother suffered from muscular dystrophy, and it upset the apple cart with our family because we had to watch him suffer and wither away and die when he was 33 years old. Is chronic disease considered no hope?
Well, that's an interesting question. Part of, I guess, what I'm trying to describe is a situation where chronic disease was either considered a no-hope situation in the 19th century, or even worse than that, it was incurable, and it was actually excluded from hospitals, which should focus on those who were curable. It was also very much associated, as I mentioned before, with the very poor and the very elderly populations that not many people cared about. One of the things that, of course, happens in the early 20th century is hope and the at least the ambition of being able to, if not cure, at least ameliorate, and if not ameliorate, at least stabilize many chronic diseases that had been considered incurable before. And this was a very, very widespread thing. It starts with tuberculosis in the 1880s when sanatoria become available. It continues with cancer when radium therapy becomes available in the early 1920s. Insulin therapy becomes available for diabetes. So one of the things that's driving this is there's still an area of what is considered incurability. There's still a very large area of incurability, which at best demands a humanitarian response. There is a demand to take care of people who can't be cured. But above all, there's a new optimism that with enough American money and know-how, all of these diseases are somehow, if not curable, ameliorable. Neurological diseases were a particular problem because they were not understood. They really were not understood until, even today they're not very well understood, but they certainly weren't understood in the period that I'm talking about, the 1930s, 40s, and 50s.
John, thank you for the call. I'm very sorry about your brother. Dale on Facebook writes, chronic diseases weren't so chronic many years ago. People died from them a lot sooner. And then says, on a serious note, when I was younger, people got a lot more exercise and a lot less fast food. And I guess talk about that. Chronic diseases weren't so chronic years ago because people just died from them sooner.
That's partly true. The whole question of how many people died of chronic diseases and is a really interesting one because the historical actors themselves became very agitated by this issue. By the 1920s, reformers, chronic disease reformers, could argue that chronic diseases were much more common than they had been before. It's not so much that they were sick longer than they had been before, but that there were more people with cancer and with heart disease and with diabetes. And the answer was actually exactly what your correspondent said. The reason for it was said to be civilization, a sedentary lifestyle, bad food, too much alcohol, lack of exercise. This was the 1920s in which racism was very much a part of the culture. So part of the answer was that certain races were particularly responsible for the decline of health. The problem was that you're dealing with statistics, in most cases, death statistics, that are very, very unreliable. Doctors came in to homes where they didn't know the people who were sick, and they attributed whatever the fashion of the day was to cause of death. And so the fashion of the day changed from things like old age and senility and exhaustion to specific diseases, largely because specialties had developed around specific diseases like oncology and like cardiology. That being said, there was certainly agreement that infant mortality had declined. It was still a very serious problem in the early 20th century, that infant mortality had declined and that more people were living into middle and older age where one would expect chronic diseases to develop. The question was how much of that of the apparent rise, and it seemed like a very, very dramatic rise for some people, how much of it was due to this changing age structure? It wasn't so much that people died earlier from chronic diseases. It's that more people lived into middle age to develop chronic diseases.
It's interesting, too, we're talking about the focus on, you know, eating better and exercising more. We hear that still today with the obesity epidemic and the public health effort to try to combat obesity.
Yes, you hear the same thing today. And what's even more surprising is I'm now sort of looking internationally at the global health movement. The WHO is making exactly the same kinds of arguments in Asia and even Africa, where there's a huge infectious disease problem with malaria and with AIDS, but where chronic diseases seem to be developing. And there again, the argument is that Africans and Asians have borrowed the worst features of Western lifestyle, and they are now eating as badly as we are. They are now exercising almost as little as we are. And therefore, we are beginning to see, at least that's the argument, we are beginning to see significant rises in incidence of various chronic diseases, ranging from cancer to heart disease and diabetes, while at the same time, in places like Africa, I mean, AIDS and malaria are the major infectious, transmissible diseases.
We'll pick up on that point after we check news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. It is 6:36 on this Tuesday, April 22nd. We are talking with the author of Chronic Disease in the 20th Century, A History, talking about how the concept of chronic disease evolved and shaped our healthcare systems. Our guest says that the concept of chronic disease developed differently in the United States than it did in Europe. And we're looking at the medical and public health and political policy responses to it. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Just before news time, Professor Wise, you were talking about in the World Health Organization, for example, is focusing a lot of effort on combating chronic disease that is associated with obesity, as we see a lot of effort in this country to do the same thing, and not so much on, or more so than, on the infectious diseases like AIDS or malaria, which are the biggest killers there. Talk a little bit more about that. Why would the World Health Organization do that?
Well, I shouldn't say more. Okay. The World Health Organization has been behaving to a certain degree in a parallel way to the U.S. Public Health Service in the 1930s. It's trying to expand its scope beyond infectious diseases in the poor and middle-income countries, as they're called today, the developing countries. And they've been making a conscious effort to develop a strategy that is comprehensive, that kind of deals with many different chronic diseases. Rather than having a cancer program and a cardiovascular program and a diabetes program, they've been thinking in terms of comprehensive programs since approximately 1985.
Is there anything wrong with that?
There's nothing wrong with that. There's absolutely nothing wrong with that. The focus has been largely on behavior changes. There seem to be three strategies, preventive strategies, that have proven to be somewhat effective. The first one is cutting down on smoking. And that's a really, really big one. And there, it's not just a matter of modifying behavior, but countries have actually signed an agreement to raise taxes on cigarettes in order to try to lower smoking incidence.
Mm-hmm.
The second one is food. Eating properly. And this, of course, involves more than just trying to change people's behavior. It involves dealing with food companies in terms of trying to produce healthier foods and not becoming, you know, changing crops so that the population doesn't become dependent on a single crop with limited nutritional capacity. And the third one is exercise, trying to improve that. Now, in addition to that, there are also environmental factors that are recognized. Now, I say that they have been placing a lot of emphasis on this. The emphasis, I must say, is largely rhetorical. The big money, like, you know, 95% of the money, still goes for AIDS and malaria and child health. What you have is what you've had really since about 1998 has been a lot of talk and the creation of a lot of pilot programs that are changing the way global health workers are seeing developing countries, but which have yet to be translated into big bucks. The big bucks, if you take a look at the various charts of what foreign donors to poorer countries are actually giving, the big bucks are not yet for a chronic disease.
So how has the evolving concept of chronic disease affected patients in the United States?
Well, it's a complicated story because one of my arguments is that why would you lump together so many diseases as a chronic disease? And I guess my answer has been that in the absence of a comprehensive healthcare system that deals with the entire population, you need some kind of unifying framework that allows people to act. And in the post-World War II period, when there was enormous amount of building and reorganization of healthcare institutions, that gives some kind of coherence to that planning and to that reorganization. And the United States was in a very, very odd situation where the major organizations could not agree about one really, really fundamental issue, and that was health insurance. The American Medical Association was violently against it. The American Public Health Association and the American Public Welfare Association were for it. So one of the things that happened in the United States that was absolutely unique in the national arena is that a private commission was set up in 1947 called the Commission for Chronic Illness. And that included the AMA, the American Hospital Association, the American Social Welfare Association, the American Public Health Association. The U.S. Public Health Service was deeply involved in giving money and providing expertise. And the policy for chronic disease that emerged, reflected the enormous complexity of chronic health policy and the many different kinds of issues, and I can talk about that in a moment, that chronic disease raises, but it also had to combine the different interests of the various groups who were members of this commission. So, for instance, the American Medical Association imposed the idea that most chronic disease prevention and care had to take place in private medical practice. And were violently opposed to any kind of nationalized health service. So what you got was this four-volume, extraordinary report about dealing with prevention. Chronic care prevention was the first volume. The second volume was about long-term care. And what you get out of these things is this extraordinarily complex policy that takes chronic disease as a spectrum, this long, lifelong spectrum, where you start with prevention, early prevention, through screening, through changing behavior, and which ends up in the worst case scenario with dying or permanently infirm people who are in some sense dependent either on institutions or on people, if they're at home, people taking care of them. So it's an extremely broad concept. And the Americans tried to work on all fronts. There was a major hospital rebuilding campaign that initially was meant to create hospitals for rural areas, but by the mid-1950s was increasingly giving money to hospitals to create chronic care wards, develop nursing homes for people who couldn't take care of themselves, develop home care to keep people out of hospitals. The public health organizations in every state began to create chronic disease units. Experiments were made with something called multi-phase screening, with the idea that you could do a whole bunch of tests at the same time and analyze them at the same time very, very cheaply, and therefore discover diseases at an early state in a large part of the population. So it was an extraordinarily ambitious effort in comparison with what was going on in other countries, but it was also so wide-ranging and based, in many cases, on things that turned out to be very, very problematic. Multiphasic screening didn't work. It just didn't work. In the end, we've ended up with possibly three general kinds of screening that seem to be effective, although it's quite controversial. The notion that hospitals should integrate chronic diseases, not just acute cases of chronic diseases, but long-term stable cases of chronic diseases, ran up against financial constraints. It proved to be far too expensive. Home care and nursing homes were developed on a very large scale in the United States, causing all sorts of problems because these were run by private companies, so there were claims of abuse. There were a lot of fires that took place in nursing homes. These things were very, very difficult to regulate. So one of the things that you get in the United States is a range of institutions for dealing with the various chronic diseases, as a kind of a single manageable entity that was really quite unique in the international arena.
We're going to need to take a short break, and then we'll continue talking about how the concept of chronic disease evolved in the United States, how it was different than it was elsewhere, and what it means for patients and for our healthcare system. And we welcome your questions at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org or post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. So what is the U.S. Doing right and doing wrong when it comes to trying to deal with chronic disease? I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Kerr-Dean, talking with George Wise, who is a professor of social studies and medicine at McGill University and author of the book Chronic Disease in the 20th Century, A History. We're examining that history and how it led to where we are today in our healthcare system with regards to trying to treat chronic disease. And we're welcoming your questions at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Kerr-Dean Show Facebook page. Professor Wise, is our different reaction to response to trying to deal with chronic disease, the reason why the United States does not have a national health care system, whereas much of Europe does?
No, I actually would make the exact opposite argument. And I would say that the lack of a national insurance system has been one of the reasons why the United States has put so much emphasis on dealing with a chronic disease problem. For one thing, and the members actually of the Commission on Chronic Illness in the 1950s admitted this, they could not agree about insurance, but they could agree that chronic disease was a bad thing and that something should be done about it. So that's the first reason. The second reason is that there has been a tradition in the United States to provide public health care for the most needy patients. So who are the most needy patients? Well, they're the very, very poor. They're the elderly who tend to be sicker than other people. And I suppose children, but for the moment we won't talk about children. But if you talk, and as well, the disabled. So when you look at where public money has gone, and Medicare and Medicaid are perfect examples of it, they have disproportionately dealt with populations that suffer from various forms of chronic disease. And the argument has been made that there is a kind of circular effect. It makes public support for healthcare very expensive. If that is your focus, and American public American healthcare is much more expensive than healthcare elsewhere. The other side of it is that if you have a national health service or a national insurance system, you deal with an entire population, and you deal with the problems of that entire population, and you don't focus on specific groups and specific diseases in quite the same way as you would in the American system.
Yeah,
the focus in the UK and in France has been in expanding access to healthcare, trying to deal with the costs of providing healthcare to an entire population. There's been less concern with a general concept like chronic disease that goes from prevention to palliative care at the two extremes, and there's been much more emphasis on trying to provide services for mainly elderly people, because chronic disease in Europe has been traditionally viewed as a problem of the elderly. Trying to provide proper services for them, not even necessarily medical services, while the medical system it's probably unfair to say that it's ignored the problems of chronic disease, but they have defined chronic disease very narrowly as the health problems of the elderly. And one of the things that you get in England is, rather than a chronic disease set of policies, is you get geriatrics that emerges in Britain as one solution to that part of the chronic disease problem that is important for the British.
Mm-hmm. Well, as we're running short on time here, I mean, what's your takeaway from this research you did on the history of chronic disease?
Well, my takeaway is, I guess, a number of things. There are theoretical, you know, there are sort of conceptual takeaways, which is that this kind of policy concept is not universal, and people create concepts that do work for them, that allow them to organize the world in ways that make sense to them and that allows them to act. And Americans, their world has been a very different world, their healthcare world, than the European world, and therefore their concepts have been different. But I think my other takeaway, and this is the more practical takeaway, is, you know, Americans always thought that there was some sort of quick fix for the problems of chronic disease. And one of the things that we're, you know, one of the things that we're learning, or one of the things that I come away with, is just how complicated and intractable many of these issues really, really are. Some of the most effective things that you can do are, in fact, extraordinarily expensive, really, really expensive. And some of the things that we thought were very effective, like screening, like annual physical examinations, which Americans sort of accepted as kind of general policy in the 1940s and 50s and continue to this day, have proven to be totally ineffective in actually, you know, changing mortality or even incidence. Maybe not incidence of disease, it's increased. If you're doing screening, you're going to find more diseases.
Yeah.
So we found more diseases, but that doesn't necessarily mean we can do a lot more about them. And, you know, some issues are just really, really complicated. So I would not say that the American effort to deal with chronic disease was a failure. To say that is to assume that there's a simple answer that Americans didn't find. And one of the things that I find actually quite admirable is that Americans, for whatever their reasons, some of the reasons, like trying to prevent health insurance, were not so admirable. But nonetheless, the effort that was made to deal with the chronic disease problem was unprecedented internationally and is in some ways very admirable and very, very impressive. But it's a very, very hard issue. And I think we have to be prepared to buckle down. We're dealing with the long run here. We're dealing with four or five different strategies for dealing with it. And
yeah.
Much of the argument is about which of the strategies one should be using. Should we be spending, for instance, so much money on trying to find cures for chronic disease?
We'll have to save that discussion for another time. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.